are very talented, but there is too much accompaniment, Napoleon said. He mentioned an aria by Giovanni Paisiello as an example of the sort of thing he liked. Cherubini had heard it before. He remained calm. Citizen consul, I write in French tastes. In the words of the proverb, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Your music makes too much noise, Napoleon declared. Speak to me like Paisiello does. Lull me gently. Cherubini couldn't resist a comeback that would cost him dearly. I understand, he said. You like music that doesn't keep you from thinking about state affairs. When a lucrative position came up, Paisiello got it, and for the next 2 years, the downcast Luigi Cherubini wrote little music, choosing instead to devote himself to his botanical pursuits. Well, maybe Napoleon didn't care so much for Luigi Cherubini or his music, but Beethoven said he was the greatest of his contemporaries. What's the appeal of Cherubini's music to us today? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What were the challenges for Cherubini writing in the turbulent times of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic years? How innovative and influential was he, and how does his opera Medea hold up after more than 200 years? Our guest is William Farlow, director of the UW Opera and director of its production of Cherubini's Medea, to be performed November 9th, 11th, and 13th in Music Hall at the UW-Madison.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you so much.
Before we get to the upcoming production of Medea, let's talk about Cherubini and why he's not a household word the way Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms and so many others are. I mean, why did Beethoven admire him so much if he's kind of more or less not that well known now?
Luigi Cherubini, he was sort of seemed to be sort of stuck between two worlds. He was a bridge between the classical period and the beginning of the romantic period. And like a number of composers, he was, you know, not influential at his time, but proved to be a big influence, especially with this opera, for those to come. It was not only Beethoven, but Weber, Schumann, Wagner, and Brahms who liked him and adored this opera. I mean, you know, when you think of that, you know, Wagner didn't have much nice to say about anybody except Beethoven. I mean, I think that's a supreme compliment. He didn't have a big career until he got to Paris. And the interesting thing about Cherubini in this piece is of the around 2,000 stage works that were premiered during that revolutionary decade, Medea is the only one who still maintains any place in the repertoire. The only composition that people might have run across of his is most likely his Requiem, which is a wonderful piece, and you will hear it's a favorite choral orchestra piece.
He was versatile, as so many composers were and had to be back in the late years of the 18th century, early years and the early years of the 19th century. I mean, he wrote six quite respected, almost landmark string quartets late in life, as well as various other kinds of music in the course of a long career, and so he did have that advantage, of at least, of you know, having an appeal to a younger generation after his own had perhaps passed into some obscurity.
Yes, but his landmark is best appreciated, I think, in works of other composers. Beethoven's Fidelio wouldn't have been the opera it was without Medea. There was another composer around the time, a little later, Luigi Spontini, whose works were a lot actually like this Medea. His Spontini also had a big success in Paris, and he wrote an opera called La Vestale, which was premiered in 1807. And when you hear that music, it's a lot like it, you know.
And how would you compare Cherubini to Mozart? I mean, they came along at similar time.
Exactly, because this Cherubini's Medea, which was premiered in 1797, was just a few years after Mozart's death. First of all, it's a French opera. Mozart didn't write French operas. He wrote Italian opera style, and Singspiel, German Singspiel. These serious French operas were based on classical themes. This Medea is based on a play by Corneille, and it didn't have the... you know, it's interesting. There's no wasted time in Mozart operas, but this piece strikes me as even being more taught. You know, there's no wasted space in there. The original was in French with a lot of spoken dialogue. Then years later, in 1854, I think, a composer by the name of Lachner wrote...
Franz Lachner.
Yeah, wrote these recitatives. In fact, the composer and conductor Luigi Arditi had written... recitatives for the Italian version. I've never heard or seen those. That would be fascinating. But they're just not the same. With Cherubini is at once reaching further back than Mozart and reaching further ahead. I don't know how else to explain it. Mm-hmm. I just don't know how else to explain it. It's just, it all works together, yet when you take it apart, it's like, I wonder how all of this, you know, fits in, but it's a perfectly cohesive piece.
And is it in terms of the singing difficulty? How does it compare to some of the other operas of the time?
The title character of Medea is one of the most difficult in the entire repertoire. There is absolutely no reason to do this opera with all of its charms unless you have a soprano who is fully capable of doing justice.
In terms of range or what kinds of difficulties?
Emotional range.
It's got, technically speaking, musically speaking, it's got a very wide vocal range. There are so many changes of style. This seamless cantilena legato, slow stuff, not much, not melismas, but extremely fast music, huge emotional range, such profound despair, and this just towering rage, you know. And she's always on the stage. The title character comes on in the middle of Act One, and she stays on stage through the rest of the opera, you know.
And he's drawing his story from where? I mean, he has a libretto, apparently.
Yes, and based on the play by Corneille.
And can you give us a quick version of the myth of Medea, the storyline?
Well,
that this is based
on? Jason and the Argonauts had come to, I can't remember where Medea was from, Colchos. Yeah, that's where it was, Colco. And she fell in love with him, and the sacred object of her people was the Golden Fleece. And through her magic, she was a sorceress, she got the fleece for Jason, and they fled. And they were being pursued by Medea's brother and her father. Medea was hacked up her brother in various pieces, and the father kept stopping to gather the parts of his son's body, thereby allowing... Jason and Medea to escape. They had two sons together, and Jason got tired of her, and he took the boys and went to Corinth. And as the opera starts, it's the day of the wedding. He is marrying King Creon's daughter, in this version, Glauce. And Medea shows up, and she's not very happy.
That's an understatement.
About it.
What kind of overture does Cherubini give us? Is this one where we hear little hints of main themes of the opera, or is it in the earlier sense where it is just an overture? It could fit any opera, as the kind of thing Rossini did, or is there some kind of a match
here?
You
know, it's not a potpourri of the hit tunes. It's a hugely dramatic piece, and I can't conceive of it. Of course, you can say that of some of the Rossini overtures he's used for more than one opera. But this is such a perfect overture for this. It is unbelievably turbulent and intense and in a minor key, which is a rarity, actually. It's in F minor. You can certainly tell the influence. When you hear this overture, you think immediately of the overture to Bellini's Norma, which
come about 30 years later.
Yeah, which Bellini didn't write overtures, but he wrote one for Norma. And it's a lot like this Cherubini.
Let's hear the overture.
We heard the La Scala Orchestra with Tullio Serafin conducting the overture to Medea, the opera, 1797 opera by Luigi Cherubini. It stands, you've said already, Bill, as the masterpiece by far, head and shoulders above his other operatic works. But where does it stand roughly chronologically? Is it, he had operas before it, he had operas after it?
Yes. His major successes came after he moved to Paris, in which there were three or four operas, and Medea was sort of in the middle of that output. Earlier in his career, he had written a number of Italian comic operas, which, you know, had moderate success. Then he went to London and wrote, you know, some more comic operas, and that wasn't such a big hit. Then he, on advice from the Italian composer and violinist Viotti, he moved to Paris. And not unlike Gluck, he had big success there. But Medea is sort of square in the middle of his mature pieces.
While we were listening to that, you said that this overture and the whole opera, in fact, jumped out at you when you were young.
I was 15 years old and checked out the LPs from the El Paso, Texas Public Library, brought them home. I had already heard an awful lot of opera, and I'd heard some Callas recordings. But when I put this on from the very beginning of the overture, I just felt sort of this different kind of energy and electricity. It was one instance, familiar, yet something completely different. And to this day, which is nigh soon to be 50 years later, I feel the same things about this piece. Familiar, yet still not only contemporary, but still looking to some place we have not been, you know.
I'm fascinated by that date, 1797, and Paris, which sounds like an exciting, perhaps even a dangerous time and place for anybody. We're talking about, well, the aftermath of the French Revolution. Yes. And the rapid rise of Napoleon and the whole Napoleonic Empire. How did Cherubini fit into that scene?
He wasn't a favorite, as you pointed out, of Napoleon's. And at that period of time, shortly thereafter, this kind of French opera was going out of style. In fact, a few years later, about 10 years later, in 1807, Luigi Spontini's Le Vestal was like this kind of piece. But that kind of French opera was going out. It took the French opera a long time to hit their stride again, and they finally did with Berlioz, although his stuff was not a big success. But
yes,
the operas
later,
of,
yes,
of Gounod and that kind of opéra lyrique. But, you know, he was not – he was admired in his by some really great people in his times, but he didn't – it wasn't like another Mozart or, you know, Rossini or – you know, those.
It's interesting how those reputations rise and fall.
The other thing about this piece, and I think a lot of it has to do not only with the French opera style, but with the title character. If a singer takes on a certain role, then the opera becomes extremely famous because they carry it around with them. But none of the sopranos at that time or the next generation did. The great Italian soprano Giuditta Pasta, for whom Bellini wrote Sonnambula and Norma and Donizetti wrote Anna Bolena and all of this stuff, she had a big success as Medea. But it was in the opera by a German composer, Mahler, Medea in Corinto.
I notice in your write-up for the UW opera performance of Medea that you mentioned both of your female leads.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about the two female characters and the relationship they have and some of the duets and so on?
The first solo piece we hear is the aria for, in the Italian version, her name is Glauce. She is the princess of King Creon, whom Jason is going to marry. It's one of the two arias in this opera that have a featured obbligato solo instrument. In this aria, it's a solo flute. This piece is nothing like anything else in the opera. It's a real fantastic display for a solo flute, and sort of a coloratura soprano, there's a whole lot of fast notes in this. You don't hear this in any other piece in the opera. Yet, it's part of the opera. It fits in perfectly to it. But it's there again, even within it, it's not like anything else in the opera.
And what are they saying to each other?
Glauce has had these forebodings even on the day of her wedding. She just has this, she's not at ease. And her servants and the female chorus have been telling her, but you know, today is your wedding day. You have everything else to, you have everything to be happy for, and the gods are smiling at you. And she says, you know, you're absolutely right. And then she talks about, she sings to the god of love and how happy she is. But in the middle of the aria, all of a sudden she talks about, you know, these dreadful feelings again, but in good aria style, she comes back to the happy.
Sounds like something that will almost parallel a good overture.
Mm-hmm. You know? And it's a real showpiece. It's a real showpiece, too.
And who is our singer for Glauce?
A very young Renata Scotto. It's all from this same performance with conductor Tullio Serafin in the Teatro alla Scala.
Young and very nimble Renata Scotto there with Glauce's aria from Medea by Luigi Cherubini. And, well, it's easy to say, well, it sounds like Mozart, but they were writing at the same time and in somewhat the same environment. So it's not as if one is being influenced by the other.
No.
And we're going to hear a song by the title character of Medea when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is William Farlow, who is the director of the upcoming production of Luigi Cherubini's 1797 opera Medea, with the UW-Madison involved, and it's going to be performed at Music Hall November 9th, 11th, and 13th, Cherubini's Medea. Now, you said earlier, Bill, that this opera in particular by Cherubini reaches back to earlier times but points also into later times, by which we mean into the 19th century. Well, we just heard, though, that Glauce's aria sounds, you know, very classical to me, as I said, you know, like something Mozart might have written.
Yes.
So where in this opera do we find the harbinger of the future that you were referring to?
It's at the end of Act One. Medea has an aria in which she begs Jason to come back to her with her sons, De tuoi figli la madre, and it's a slow classical aria, very formal, but with much more interest in the accompaniment. But right after that, Jason says, your pleas are in vain. Did you not hear the king exile you from his kingdom? The only thing I'm thinking about is how happy I am, and I'm going to marry Glauce. And now we get pushed off the edge of a cliff here, because now we hear this immense amount of rage and this boiling, fidgety kind of accompaniment, a lot of notes in the violins, again in a minor key, E minor. And we begin to hear this sort of much more angular lines from the soprano with this huge range, you know. But it's not like anything we've had. We're sort of hurled into some other realm of music and drama at that point, and we stay pretty much there for the rest of the opera.
As if crossing into the Romantic period?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
And who will be singing the aria? Would be Renato Scotto back?
No, the tenor is Mirto Picchi, well-known tenor at the time, but hardly heard. People don't remember him. And then, of course, now we finally get to hear the great Maria Callas in the title role.
Il corte strapperò, e me lo sarò di te.
passion.
Yep.
I think we may have left the 18th century behind there.
Yes.
That's quite a voice that Maria Callas has.
She did, and she just it's absolutely just fearless singing. And, you know, you have to be careful when you sing this kind of music, because if your emotions get – if you let your emotions really get away from you, then you end up damaging yourself. But you have to be fearless if you're going to sing this kind of music. You know.
It seems to me this opera is not performed all that often.
No.
You know, most, I mean, it's not one of those chestnuts that we encounter on the program a lot of times. What do you think we miss out on the most by not having it performed more?
Well, you can never do this piece without – the only reason to do this piece is if you have an extraordinary soprano who is fully capable of doing this. What you miss in not hearing it – is all the other great stuff that is not just for the title character. These wonderful choruses, this beautiful prayer for three soloists in the chorus, Glauce's aria, Neri's aria, this wonderful offstage music. There's a lot of offstage music in this opera. The whole end of Act Two is offstage for the chorus and three of the principals. Medea is the only person singing on stage. That's what you miss when you don't get to hear it. But it's also not an opera you'll just do to be doing it so people can be exposed to it. You have to have an extraordinarily gifted soprano. And we're fortunate here in the University of Opera of having not one but two. So you have to come to at least two of the three performances to hear the different sopranos sing this.
Is it a fairly physical opera in terms of the staging, the action?
It can be. The thing about these kinds of dramas is that the turmoil is emotional and it's in interior. It's not about running around like, you know, Scarpi and Tosca.
Chasing somebody with a knife.
You know, chasing each other around in Act Two. That is more a contemporary kind of depiction of rage. Medea does a lot of pacing. She's like a trapped animal to me. I'm a huge lover of cats, and she always strikes me as some sort of panther that is getting ready to pounce on somebody. The music is that way too. The title character is extremely still a great deal of the time. And when you hear the whole opera, you hear how still so much of her music is. And then like a cat, without warning, she just pounces on you with teeth bared.
What about the themes of this work? I mean, you've mentioned her rage and how important that is, how much we feel her rage. But what is it that comes out in terms of, I guess, the themes that we would take away from this work?
You mean emotional?
Yeah. If you were going to adapt Medea to today.
Oh, well,
then,
I mean,
if you were going to take from it certain things, what would you do?
Well, I mean, as the saying goes, nothing's new since the Greeks. These plays that they made, Electra, the Trojan Women, you name it, are all archetypes. We've seen them throughout history and we have them today. Sadly, we hear on the news or, you know, see on television that a woman has murdered her children or a father has murdered the children because of the fact that they despise their former spouse and they believe that they can't bear the thought of their children being raised by somebody else or will never forget that these children were fathered by a man who has betrayed them. It happens today.
You mentioned the influence upon Beethoven's Fidelio. So how did that come out? Let's see, Fidelio is about 1805 or so.
I can't remember because there were three or four versions before he actually got
well,
to Fidelio.
Well, that's true, yeah. He's got four different overtures for it. But within 10 years, certainly, of when Cherubini's opera came out.
Well, first of all, Leonora, in a positive way, is like Medea. An incredibly strong woman. you know, who can sort of get through anything that's coming her way. And there, too, in the title character in Fidelio, Beethoven, there are so many huge emotional changes. The character of Leonora in Beethoven's Fidelio has, I think, the exact same range as this. There are moments of huge emotional turmoil. Also, there are moments of a very nasty high tessitura in the Beethoven, the same way as
Leonora. So really
pushing
the top limits of your range.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that there's a beautiful aria by Nereis.
Yes.
What role does that character play?
Nereis is a servant of Medea's that has come with her to Corinth. And in Act Two, Medea has convinced the king to grant her one more day in Corinth before she will be banished so that she might spend time with her sons. It's a huge emotional scene at the end of which Medea collapses. And it's the one point when the soprano isn't singing, although she is still on stage, collapsed, and her servant Nereis sings this extraordinary aria with a big bassoon solo in it, explaining that, you know, no matter how bad things are, Nereis will remain faithful to Medea and, you know, sort of help her in her grief.
Thank you.
beautiful aria sung here by Miriam Pirazzini. And we are going to return to the more stormy, passionate side of the opera Medea when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Cherubini is one of the most difficult of all composers to place. His place in history is perhaps better explained by his dates than by his words, for he was born in 1760, only 4 years later than Mozart, and died in 1842 in the full flood tide of the Romantic movement. Consequently, he partakes to a great extent of the characteristics of both periods. That's from Cecil Gray's History of Music. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is William Farlow, and he's here talking about Cherubini's opera Medea, which is being performed by the University Opera three times here in Madison. It will be performed Friday, November 9th at 7:30 p.m., Sunday, November 11th at 3 p.m., and Tuesday, November 13th at 7:30 p.m. in Old Music Hall in Madison. So take us to the end of this magnificent and little performed opera.
Medea has just sent Nereus into the temple with her two sons, and she is left alone. And she says, Eke, io son Medea, and so I am Medea, and I am to let these children live whose father has done these awful things. She goes sort of back and forth, and then finally she sort of summons the Furies and everything else, and she has a dagger, and she's going to run into the temple and murder her children. And just as she is about to enter, you hear this chorus mourning off stage. Medea has sent a crown, a diadem, and a cloak as a wedding present to Glauce, which of course has this flesh-eating poison.
Of course.
And the chorus is mourning the death of Glauce, and the tenor, Jason, is heard offstage mourning. And that's, if there was ever any doubt in Medea's mind about whether to kill her children or not, that absolutely clinches it. She runs into the temple. Jason comes on stage wanting to know what happens. He runs into the, going to run to the temple, and Medea comes out with the dagger saying, you know, I killed them because they were your children.
And what happens musically that's special in that final act?
This gloomy and unsettling music at the beginning of this finale, when Medea's trying to figure out what it is she must do.
Maria Callas as Medea, with some issues that need to be resolved, not yes. necessarily happily for everyone,
no.
by the end of Luigi Cherubini's 1797 opera Medea, which, as you say, Bill Farlow, looks back to the 18th century and certainly forward into the 19th. In fact, you even mentioned a little earlier that, oh, that sounds like something Verdi was going to be doing many years later.
Well, at the end of the aria that we heard for the mezzo with the bassoon, there are these passages in the violin which sounds like a direct lift that Verdi put into the sleepwalking scene from his early opera on Macbeth. I think it's exactly the same notes.
So Cherubini was sort of ahead of his time.
Oh, yes.
And influential in ways that are not immediately apparent. True. Even though this opera, so far as we know, has never been done at the Met and is not part
it's
of
never
the
been done
big
at the,
repertory.
No, never been done at the Met. San Francisco did it for Eileen Farrell. City Opera did it for Marilyn Niska. I don't think they did it in Chicago, but they have never done it at the Met.
It must be fun to sort of stage something like that here in Madison, then, where you know for many people it will be their only chance.
Absolutely,
to see,
but we've done that a lot at the University.
That's sort of your charge in some ways, isn't it?
Yep.
Well, this performance by the UW Opera with director William Farlow of Cherubini's Medea will take place November 9th, 11th, and 13th in Music Hall, and it will feature as the chorus, the UW Madrigal Chorus, directed by Bruce Gladstone, and the orchestra will be conducted by Andrew Sewell. So it will be certainly an action-packed performance coming up in a little later in November.
Yes.
William Farlow, thanks for joining us for this hour.
And thank you so much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can be with us for the next hour of University of the Year.